Gentrification has touched almost every major American city, from New York and San Francisco to Detroit and Sacramento. And in many cases, it's been accompanied by displacement. Longtime residents, especially residents of color, pushed out as prices rise. As cities look for solutions, author Matthew Sherman points to the decades-long history of gentrification and the lessons that come with it. Matthew is a senior editor at WNYC in New York and author of Newcomers, Gentrification and Its Discontents. He joins us now. Hi, Matthew.
Thanks so much for having me.
And you start in this book by saying that gentrification isn't necessarily a bad thing.
That's right. It's really just a process by which a neighborhood goes from being, say, a little less than the median income for the area to above. It's sort of you got to think of it as a neutral phenomenon, like gravity or wind or rain. You know, they can get you really wet and be really damaging, right? Mm-hmm. Or if you figure out how to harness those elements, then you can actually maybe turn into something to your benefit.
Well, and if you said the word gentrification to one person, they might have a positive thought about it, and another person might think it's the worst thing in the world.
Yes. I have to say, when I started reporting, people in New York seemed to think gentrification was just fine. It was just sort of a normal thing. People would even joke about how they were part of it. And then I started reporting out in San Francisco, and it was just a bad word. I could not use that word when I was telling people what I was reporting on.
When did gentrification as we know it begin?
I think it started in the 1950s. That's where I start my book. You could argue it started even earlier in the 1930s, Georgetown, 1910s, Greenwich Village in New York. But I picked late 1950s, because that's when this group of people in Brooklyn Heights really were self-conscious about wanting to live in the city, not go to the suburbs like so many of their white counterparts were doing. And they were also against urban renewal. That is sort of the wholesale demolition of slums and replacement with large concrete boxy buildings.
They saw themselves as pioneers who were civilizing the urban frontier.
Yes, and I don't think they realized at the time how racist that might sound to people, but I think looking back on it, we really question that sort of language and that attitude, as if these neighborhoods were not good neighborhoods or functional neighborhoods beforehand.
But a lot of these people were focused on preservation, on historic preservation, restoring some of these beautiful old buildings that had been in disrepair.
That's right. They wanted to restore the buildings. They thought differently sometimes about the neighborhoods, although some of them really, you know, appreciated the diversity, the vibrancy that they found in these city neighborhoods as well. It almost became a problem, though, too much of a good thing, as the gentrifiers moved into these neighborhoods, sort of overwhelmed them, and then many, many years later have started to push people out.
And how much did the city leaders get involved when this was happening? Did they look at it and say, okay, we need to set the rules of how gentrification is going to happen? Or did they say, well, you know, well, let's just see what happens with this?
Pretty much they were pretty hands-off about it. And that's what's interesting, is that it's more a question of what they didn't do as opposed to what they did. Mm. A lot of the problems with urban renewal, for example, or where people placed public housing in this country have to do with things that public policymakers, government leaders did. But it was more that some mayors saw this coming, economic development officials, and they thought, this is fantastic. It doesn't take any public money at all. People are reviving the city on their own.
What did gentrification look like in Chicago compared to New York? Because you spent some time on Chicago. I actually lived right next to Cabrini Green, which was this old housing project that you talk about. But now it's, you know, two blocks away from a Crate and Barrel. So it's changed very rapidly. How did it differ from what happened in New York?
That example, I should say that there are plenty of other examples in Chicago where gentrification did happen in sort of the more traditional way, where you have an old neighborhood like Old Town or Lincoln Park, Wicker Park, etc. People move in, privately renovated. But I wanted to look at what happens when you take an entire public housing complex and you try to, in essence, gentrify it. They didn't use that name. They didn't see it as gentrifying it. They wanted to break up that concentrated poverty. They were trying to solve a problem and undo all the mistakes of the past. But they sort of used the spirit of gentrification and the dynamic of it, basically by moving a lot of low-income people out of there to other places, and then inviting middle and upper middle income people in. And the most amazing thing is just that these class lines persisted even when people were intentionally integrated with one another. They built these buildings so that there would be no difference in the apartments, where they were placed. They all looked the same, whether they're subsidized for low-income people or whether they were market rate. And nonetheless, these class differences really came out, and there has been a lot of tension and resentment since then.
Where do you think we are right now in the long history of gentrification? Is this the boom of it? There are so many neighborhoods in this country that are changing so rapidly, that are gentrifying so much right now. Is this more than we've seen in the past, or where are we?
Definitely more. There was a study by Governing Magazine that basically looked at gentrification, found that between 2000 and 2010, it was one out of every five low-income urban census tract had gentrified. So we'll wait, and next year after the census data comes out, we'll see. But it certainly seems like it's accelerating. I get gentrification alerts, Google alerts, from places like Auburn, South Carolina, Buffalo, New York, places that you would never think would gentrify are experiencing that now.
Are we getting any better at it?
We are getting more conscious of it. The biggest issue, though, is that so often it seems like every city discovers gentrification all over again. They pretend, or they act, or maybe they genuinely didn't see it coming, and they have to reinvent the wheel. When in fact, if you look back in the 1970s, when people became conscious of gentrification, a lot of those solutions that are being presented now were actually presented 40 years ago.
Let's talk about some solutions to gentrification. A lot of people argue that increasing the supply of housing would fix this process by bringing down prices. What did you learn about that?
I think that increasing the supply has got to be part of the solution. Absolutely. One problem is, though, that when new units are built, they always enter at the high end of the market, so that developers will build luxury units unless they're subsidized. So it takes a long time to have this filtering process where it will actually help people in the middle income or lower income strata. And that's not happening fast enough. So the experts that I've consulted recommend some sort of mixture between new market rate and new subsidized housing.
You spoke with a lot of people who were affected by gentrification personally. Is there somebody or a story that sticks in your mind?
Well, one of the people whose life I trace is Rene Yanez, and he was an artist in San Francisco, and he helped make the Mission District sort of what it is today in many ways. He started the mural movement. He co-founded an art gallery. He encouraged and fostered this sense of Chicano, Latino identity for the Mission. And, you know, lo and behold, when a neighborhood becomes attractive in that way, it also becomes the target of gentrification. We all want to live in nice, vibrant, diverse, different sorts of communities. So unfortunately, he was threatened with eviction. He fought mightily. The fact that he had such deep and extensive roots in the community no doubt helped. He got the media on his side. He got government officials on his side, and he was able to survive his final years in his same apartment.
What do you say to people who listen to this and say, well, wait a minute, gentrification, from my perspective, has made my area safer, has taken a place that may have been in disrepair and made it look beautiful, and I feel safer raising my children in this part of the city that I didn't before because of gentrification. What's wrong with that?
It's true. It goes back to the first question you asked me. Is gentrification good or bad? No, it's sort of a neutral sort of thing. It's a question of how do you tame it so that, let's say, you're not pushing people out, but you are able to get the infusion of cash and wealth that you need to improve a neighborhood. But that also raises the question, why is it that white people need to move into a neighborhood before a city starts paying attention to it? I mean, I know it's not literally that case, but that's what when you read the academic literature, you actually sort of see that academics are saying, actually, one of the benefits is that the people who stay, the low-income people who stay in these neighborhoods, they get better schools, they get better trash pickup, they get better police protection. And that's got to raise some questions, too.
Race is really at the center of this.
It's a big part of it. Yes, absolutely. I mean, there is white-on-white gentrification, absolutely. But race has certainly exacerbated the tensions that we see around gentrification. And also, if you think about, like, the African-American renter in a poor neighborhood in the 1960s or 70s. Let's say this person has enough money to buy a house, but they can't buy an apartment or a house in their neighborhood because of redlining. Banks won't lend to them. Nor can they move outside of their neighborhood because there are real estate agents who won't show them homes there. Also discrimination. They end up continuing to rent. And now that we see gentrification affecting these low-income black neighborhoods, these are the people who are most vulnerable because they have not put down the roots. They've not owned their homes. And home ownership is one of the best ways to resist gentrification.
That is Matthew Sherman, whose new book is called Newcomers, Gentrification and Its Discontents. We know you'll have thoughts about this, so leave them at hereandnow.org. Matthew, thank you.
Thank you.